This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Many, many accomplishments that this team has been acknowledged with. I'll just share three of them with you. They were, Ernst & Young picked them as Entrepreneurs of the Year. They were selected for the 30 Under 30 Coolest Entrepreneurs in America by Inc. Magazine. That's the list I wanted to get on. I wasn't cool enough. I was a great entrepreneur, just wasn't cool. And then they were also picked for the 40 Under 40 by the Pacific Coast Business Times, amongst many other awards they've received. Let's give them a warm welcome. All right, Ali, I'm going to have you start off. I didn't want to tell the whole story of your grandmother and sort of how that whole thing came about. But I think it's really an important story for the students and for anyone watching to hear, because it really did start from a need. You saw a need in the marketplace, a need in the world. You're passionate about solving that need. And then now we're sitting here, you know, 13 years later. Do you want to just share with the audience kind of what happened when you went home for Christmas? And
Sure. Yeah. So in 2001, I was a student at UC Santa Barbara. I was in my sophomore year, and I really started getting involved in the entrepreneurship program. And we had started talking about the business plan, what was called the business plan competition at the time. And at the same time, my grandmother had been put on oxygen. So when we went home for Christmas break, we were trying to look for ideas because we wanted to enter the business plan competition to win $10,000. That was our goal. And so when I went home for Christmas break, I saw my grandmother using oxygen, and every single activity that we had was centered around how much oxygen she had in her tanks and whether we had enough time to go to a play or go out to dinner. And it really changed her life. She was a very active lady. She loved to travel. And she knew once she was put on oxygen that she was going to be on it for the rest of her life. And she was actually the one who first got very frustrated and said, you know, everything else has gotten smaller, lighter, better. Why hasn't my oxygen? So I took that problem back to Brenton and Byron and said, you know, here's an idea. Let's see if we could do something. And that's when we started doing some research and realized that there really wasn't a better solution for patients like May who wanted to live that active lifestyle and have a portable unit for their oxygen. So took that and started talking about how we could potentially use and leverage different technologies, and then wrote a business plan and, of course, won the business plan competition that year. You see our lovely presentation back then, and did not know you were going to be showing that.
Well, if we'd have told you, you might not have come.
That's right.
I wanted to spring that on you. So it's kind of like you have to be careful what you wish for. So they worked really hard to win this new venture competition, and then much to their surprise, what happened at the end? Somebody came up to you, a couple people came up to you and said, hey,
yeah, so we won the competition, and frankly, you know, as we were 19 and Byron was 21 in his senior year, and we didn't immediately assume that the next step was starting a medical device manufacturing company. That was kind of a big leap. But two of the judges from the competition really thought that we had something to our idea and encouraged us to continue to pursue it. And so we just started walking down the path of, okay, let's see what else we can do. And one of those people from the competition ended up being our first CEO, and the other became our first angel investor. So it was a great connection from those judges who spent a lot of time understanding our business model, right, and felt like there was something there that could be grown into a company.
Yeah, and there's such a big difference between doing a student competition and actually having somebody say, I want to give you money, and having the other person say, I want to give you my time. I mean, that's a burden. I mean, you have to really take that as a responsibility. You can't be flippant about either of those things. So I'm sure at 19, that must have just been, you know, or 21, that must have just been quite a responsibility that you took on.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody to give a 19-year-old.
And they were successful people.
Right, right. Very successful people that give us $250,000. It was almost surreal at the time.
You should have taken it and gone to Mexico. It would have been easier.
It was a big responsibility, though. It's made it very serious.
And then we had this interesting dynamic where you guys were still in school and you were schlepping, doing pizzas, right, or something. What were you?
Exactly.
And you had to decide, do I want to, you know, I'm an adult here. These guys are still kids. I'm an adult. What am I doing?
Thanks for bringing that up. Because I'll never let the two of them forget. You know, I think the day we graduated, we raised our first round of venture funding. But for a couple of years, all of my friends graduated, got great jobs. I had a degree, but I was working downtown at CPK, waiting tables. And but looking back, of course, I mean it's one of those moments you wouldn't trade for anything. But at the time, it's difficult. You have family, wanting you to make something of this investment that they've put up for the past 4 years.
Right.
Friends getting good jobs, but I would really encourage everybody that, that is the time to try and start a company. There's no better time. And even earlier in college, we started after mid and after college, but from the very beginning. And whether it's successful or not, it doesn't really matter that much at that time, because really some of our leaps and bounds of learning came so much in those early years. And there's high points and low points and we just took it step at a time. We wanted a prototype. Then wanted our first round of venture funding and then FDA approval, and we just kept going. And through that process was, couldn't trade for anything.
Yep, and you have to break it into those pieces. I know Yulin Wong, the founder of Computer Motion, someone that I worked with for many years, he used to say inch by inch, it's a cinch, right? Yard by yard, it's hard. So if you break these things down into small steps, it's a lot easier. But I want to go back to one thing you said, which I think is hugely important for everyone in this audience to think about. You're going to have a lot of pressure on you to live a certain kind of life, a life that other people think is the right life for you. I can tell you, I really didn't jump into the entrepreneurship world until I was in my later 20s, and my parents still were, giving me the same kind of pressure they gave you, because they want what's right for their child. They were afraid of the risk and all these other things. I recently saw a study where they asked people that were at the end stage of their life, what is your biggest regret? And categorically, for men and women, it was, I wish I had lived the life I wanted to lead, not the life others wanted me to lead. So you guys are at the point now where you can make those decisions where you lead, make sure that you're leading the life that you want to lead. Right? You can't be afraid of, well, I'm not making enough money. Or you have to decide in your heart, like, is this the life I want to lead? And if it is, then the decision's easy. All right, I'm going to get a question from the audience, and we have an incentive. For the first question, we have an incredible Inogen T-shirt. I'm going to keep one, but I'll give one away. Is it an incredible question?
Yeah.
All right, let me hear it.
All right.
We need a mic. Well, while we're waiting for the mic, why don't you guys... So we know how Allie got involved. We'll get your question in a second. We know how Allie got involved. How did she kind of bring you guys into the fold? Was there a fourth? Is there like the fourth Beatle? Is there like somebody who didn't make it? Or was it always you guys?
Yeah. Allie and I worked on a project through the program previously to the competition. So it was a business analysis case of a public company, because we had been going to the lecture series for quite a while, and we wanted to get more involved, get some experience for our resumes that we thought at the time.
Right, right. So you could work at CPK.
Exactly. So we knew, we worked well together on that project, and we wanted to enter the competition. And that's when we were looking for these ideas. Christmas break happened, and Allie's grandmother was prescribed oxygen, and Brenton came into the fold being more of the technical mind of the crew.
Yeah, this was, I'd known Allie for years before this, and I'd always been the person that ended up having to fix things if she broke and that kind of stuff, so this was her way of formally locking me into
nice.
To being that role for her, so that's how I met Byron as well, was through Allie and the idea of doing the competition as a team. We figured the three-person team was right. We covered the areas, and that's how we did it.
Well, I think it's a testament to your maturity and just the relationship that you guys have established. You're all sitting up here today. As we know, many founding teams, the stress, the pressure, fill in the blank, causes the teams to to fracture over time. But hats off to you for staying friends and staying together. Okay, so we have a question out here.
All right, hi. I'm in the new venture competition class right now, so I'm going to be doing that next quarter. With your experience, what kind of advice would you give your past selves if you were like re-entering that competition?
Well, you know, I think the TMP program has done so much to help prepare for that. But what we did, you know, one of the things I think we did correctly, we did a lot of things, you know, incorrectly, but what we tried to do was stay focused on the market, because our idea of a product wasn't necessarily out of a lab in a technology that had already been done. And that's one way to start, you know, a good company. But for us, it was driven from the market. And so, you know, really the feedback we received after the competition was, you know, the technology was kind of set off to the side as maybe that could happen, maybe it couldn't. We didn't know at the time. But what we really understood was the customer, what the customer wanted. We could answer any question about the market dynamic at the time, how the business models worked, you know, inside and out. And I think a lot of people are looking for that today.
What do you think? Is that worth a shirt? You guys are too nice. So I'm curious. I didn't, in the introduction purposely, I didn't really talk a lot about the impact you guys have made on the world. I mean, I mentioned it, but not in detail. Do you guys want to share with us the number of people whose lives have changed, whatever metrics you're most proud of, any specific success stories, whatever?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we look at our space, we were creating a new type of technology for an existing channel. So the typical oxygen patient receives stationary oxygen concentrator for use when they're in the home, and then a limited number of oxygen tanks that have compressed oxygen in them. And our technology was really meant to replace the whole system and be a single solution for that product to use, whether they're in the home, they're traveling on an airplane, they're going to the grocery store, wherever they are, that's what our technology was meant to address. And at the time when we were starting the company, there was no other technology like this. We had, you know, competitors that basically said that it was impossible to create the technology that we had set our company out to create. So now, you know, now 13 years later after we started the company, we are the market leader in portable oxygen concentrators. And the shift towards that type of delivery method has accelerated. So the market for oxygen therapy grows at 7 to 10% a year. And the market for portable units like ours is growing 30 to 35% a year. And we're growing 60% a year. Nice. So significant growth and really changing the paradigm of how oxygen therapy is delivered, both in the U.S. and worldwide.
Yep. Now, I think it's important for everyone to understand there, Inogen's a typical overnight success. I mean, it took 13 years. The first almost 3 years, you were struggling with that, you know, who's right? Are the incumbents right? All these incumbents have told you it's impossible. And they literally told you it can't be done. Look, if it had been done, we would have done it, right? That's what they always say. That's what the innovator's dilemma, the people that they just can't create that disruptive technology because they're too busy doing the old school stuff. And you guys came in with something disruptive. But that had to be a fairly arduous period when you weren't able to prove it. It wasn't portable. It wasn't pulling enough oxygen out of the ambient air to be efficacy for the efficacy rate to be high enough. Excuse me. Just talk a little bit about how you dealt with that. How did you guys kind of prop each other up? What were those days like? Because it's all fun and games now when you look back, but at the time, it had to be hard.
Yeah, it was a real challenge. And again, it's the same adage: you do it one thing at a time, and you just try to go step by step, accomplishment by accomplishment. But funny story, it wasn't so funny at the time. You know, we had recruited some design help and some people that we thought had, you know, the experience and the knowledge to really help us, you know, along this path. And we're putting together our first prototype, which a lot of the assembly we're doing in our apartment and IV, and really making a go of it. But we finally got it running the night before we had kind of a board meeting for the time, and it ran for about 5 minutes and then overheated, never to run again. And so we had to go to the board meeting and, you know, kind of say, hey, we did it, but it didn't really work. So those kind of moments happen all the time. And it really does. That's, I think, why we've stayed together as a team, is we are able to support each other and shift that burden. You know, no one can bear that level of burden continuously. So being able to rely on each other for support has been really important. And the people that didn't think it could be done, there were very good reasons why they were saying that. And for us, it's been sort of a story of being on that leading edge of maybe it couldn't have been done right then. Mm. But the pieces of the puzzle, if you could see that, this is only a little bit away and we can get there. And just keeping that that dedication to just keep moving forward and keep conquering hurdles one at a time. That was was really how we approached that.
Yeah, so, and I think expanding on kind of the dynamics of the team, I mean, it's tough. There were many, many times that we thought the company's going to close the doors. It's not going to work. We're not going to be able to make payroll. We have $72 in the bank and we owe $200,000. How are we going to make it through? And I think the fact that we just kept going and trying and really believed in the vision of what we were doing, and we each could kind of take some of the weight off of each other when it got too much to bear, that was really critical to our success in those first few years when we were trying to make a go of it. And you have way too many things to do, too many and not enough time in the day. So it is important. It's absolutely critical to have the right team to your success.
And team isn't just your founders, it's your investors and the other early employees that you hire. If you have an investor group that was patient like yours and understood that what you were doing was hard, wasn't going to happen overnight, they'll stick with you when the times are bad. That's one lesson. The other lesson is don't listen to the incumbents. They're almost always wrong. Right? Ignore them, laugh at them. And thirdly, I think the other lesson I draw from that is don't be afraid to talk about your idea. Ideas are pretty cheap. You can talk about them for free. It's really going out there and making them into something that's worthwhile and expensive.
Yeah, we had the good fortune of working with a lot of people that were experts and you know, instrumental in us achieving the end goal. And they were experts not in doing what we wanted to do, but a portion of it. And it was our job to get enough pieces of the puzzle together to see the big picture. And it did mean going out and asking for help and discussing our idea and really putting it out there and trying to get them to believe that it could be done too. Because everyone wants to work on and be involved in something they think is going to go somewhere. And so that is an important part of the...
Well, and you find yourself having to convince people when even you're asking yourself, if I convince myself. And I think that's where having three people is really a big help. Let's get the next question queued up. I'll ask another question. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, is it compelling?
I think it's pretty good.
Go.
All right, so you said you had this amazing idea and you were just sophomores, right? But you didn't really have the technological experience to really formulate it. Did you guys take legal steps to stop the investors from, you know, investing in an entrepreneurial engineer who might have the skill set then, or how did that work?
For us, I think one of the biggest lessons we learned was that for us to create success, there's a lot of different ways to innovate in a market, and the product is one. And, you know, we have how many patents now? 20.
Over 20
patents that Brenton has led, and a lot of starts and stops in the design phase. But the technology is one piece, and we've, you know, really set out on a different business model as well. So I think also ideas for the venture competition is how else can you change the market? It you know, many times as a product, sometimes as a different type of service, sometimes it's the same product with an entirely different business model, a different way to reach the consumer, could be a new finance, you know, option. So for us, it was a combination of product and business model, which really, you know, set us apart. But from the very beginning, we did have to work with a lot of experts. And we worked with experts in each area of the technology to build the solution from the ground up.
I mean, I think the thing to learn from that is the idea, yes, there's value in the idea, but it's really executing on that idea. And you have to get out there and talk about your story and get investors excited about it. You can't try and keep that to yourself and expect them to want to invest in the company without really understanding it. So certainly, you know, we pursued legal help with making sure we had protection, but patents only go so far. You have to be able to defend those patents as well. So it's more about finding the right people and working with them to actually execute on the idea, not just having a great idea.
And that, it's a really common fear for someone
with an idea. They want to hold it, you know, close to their chest and keep it a secret. But if you just looked at what an investor does, right, they want to invest in a team and an idea and something that goes somewhere. They're not on the other side of the fence, right? They're very unlikely to want to take your idea and go do it. That's not the position they're in. So I think that is usually a fear that's unfounded. I don't know of any cases where that's happened. I know of a lot of cases where investors have enabled companies like ours to get off the ground and grow into something and really be successful. So it's, I think that's a little bit of an over feared scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it happens in Hollywood, right? It's like a lot of Hollywood scripts have been written based on that plot. It just doesn't happen in real life. Investors are lazy, right? We don't want to work hard. It's like, we want young people like you guys to do it. So we're not going to steal your idea. Let's get the next question queued up. Another thing I liked about your early days was you had and I'm sure it morphed and changed and you had a lot of these, but I liked your elevator pitch where you talked about the phone. And sort of the, you know what I'm talking about, right? We haven't talked about this, but yeah. Years ago you said something to me about it. I just thought, that's brilliant.
Oftentimes, we have a better one now.
I bet you do. When you have a complicated product, it really pays to have a very quick, something that everybody in the world can sort of understand. And yours, if I have it right, was you basically went through, you walked the people through, hey, look, cord phones, you know, a phone with a cord where you sort of could walk 5 feet in any direction. Then there was cordless phones where you could walk somewhere in your house, maybe. And then we had cell phones. So this idea that, you know, mobility, greater mobility is obviously worth something. And this incremental process of going, you know, from 5 feet to your house to anywhere in the world that you wanted to go. What is your new one?
Well,
that's our product analogy.
Yeah, that's our product analogy. And that's we use versions of that. Yeah. The one that we really focus on now is more about the business model, because the first few years that we started selling, we tried to sell through the channel. We tried to sell to the people who were delivering the tanks to the home and say, hey, we have a better way for you to deliver. You can get rid of your whole delivery infrastructure and we will sell you this product. And what we found is that they weren't really buying our product. They weren't adopting it as we expected them to. And so that's when in 2009, we decided to take a direct-to-consumer approach and start marketing to those consumers directly. And when we think of other industries and other challenges, we like to think back to when people there used to be an entire industry around delivering ice to people's homes. Mm-hmm. And you had that whole industry set up for the local delivery and being very efficient about delivering that very regularly to the home. And then a refrigerator came along. You didn't sell refrigerators to the people delivering ice.
Right.
And it doesn't make sense to sell portable oxygen concentrators through that channel either, because that's just not part of their core competency naturally.
Right.
Can they change their model? Yes, of course they can, but it takes effort.
Right.
And now when you look at the, you know, ice delivery industry, that basically is gone now. That's not an industry that provides value to the overall chain of keeping food cold.
Right. Well, not only is it inappropriate to try to go through that channel, your value proposition probably was worse for them, because instead of selling tanks over and over and over again that, you know, they were getting recurring revenue for, you're proposing that they sell this device once and then, you know, I'm sure there were some disposables, but basically not going back and giving tanks to those households every time.
Yeah, our product is a rental just like the tanks, but it is a complete shift in their business model, and that's difficult for providers to do. And that's, frankly, now looking back, it's easy for us to say, well, of course they didn't buy our product. It wasn't in line with their goals, and it didn't fit with their business model. But at the time, it seemed like, well, everybody else in the channel sells through these HMEs. We should sell through those people, too. That's how you get to the customer. And it took us years before we realized that you needed to innovate not only on the product, but on the go-to-market strategy.
The business model. Yeah, and that's something that everyone thinks about: product features, innovations. That's where we spend most of our time and money. But oftentimes it's the selling software directly over the Internet, like we did with GoToMeeting, GoToMyPC, selling Oxygen directly to the consumers. So what do you think that was your single biggest mistake, the channel, or was there something else? Or if you think that was the biggest one, what do you think is a close second? Was there something else you guys would have done differently with all this hindsight?
I think that's probably one example of a trait that I think we had. And, I think it's really important to really evaluate the data, of course, but then to trust your team, trust your intuition. And, it's funny, when we look back, our first business plan had a direct-to-patient and B2B model.
Right.
And, we're talking to the channel, talking to the advisors, like you spoke about, and everybody said, you can't do that. It's never been done, and, this wouldn't, work in our industry. But, and you just have to keep in mind, everyone's advice comes from their own experiences and what they've gone through. And at some point, when you've put in your research, it's just like market research. You can't just take what that interview says. You have to actually do something with the data, and that's the most valuable point. And for us, I think if we trusted each other, trusted our intuition more, it's easy to say now, but we could have avoided a lot of issues that we ended up going back on.
Right. I mean, there were still good learnings that came out of that bad experience. We learned from our bad experiences, but it probably did slow you down. Probably spent a little bit more money than you might not have had to otherwise do.
Yeah.
Do we have the next question ready? Yes.
Hello. Thank you for coming. My question is basically, as you guys were growing, if you could talk about how your job and role in the company change, and maybe how you had to adjust to other people taking higher roles and like letting people take control of your company. I was wondering if you could talk.
That was one of my questions, but that's okay.
I read it.
Yeah, I mean, I can start if you want. So it's a transition. I mean, when we start the company, you feel like it's your baby, and it's you want to make sure that you control as much as you can, because you want to make sure it goes well. So bringing in people, especially since we weren't experienced in hiring people or running a company or, having a medical device company at all, it's difficult because you don't necessarily have that skill set of, when you're interviewing, is this the right person long term for the company? So, were there things that we stumbled over? Yeah. There were some people that, looking back, we go, we made a mistake. And it certainly was a transition having, bosses when you're the founders and going, it still is, there's that weird dynamic of it's you're the founder, but they're your boss. And in the end, I think it's all about surrounding yourself with people that you really respect and that respect you. And I think if we didn't have that, then they weren't good fits for us long term. And we were lucky enough that our investors believed in us as people, as well as, the vision of the company, because without that, you can easily be replaced. And frankly, that's always a risk. It's a risk at any job at any point in time. But as founders, of course, that's a concern, because you don't want to lose your company and your idea. But it's a balance. It's all about finding people that will respect you long term.
Why don't you share, each of you, just sort of the roles? You're all vice presidents or C-level executives. Why don't you just sort of share your role now and what you did when you first started?
Sure. I mean, so
I was always involved in the technical element. So up through kind of working on concept prototypes and things, it was me. We were lucky enough to start working with a design firm here in town, conveniently headed by a professor here at UCSB, Brad Payton. So his group helped us, you know, move the needle from concept up through the engineering phase and worked with some tremendous people, very bright, a lot of respect for them today, including one of the people that eventually came to work for us from them and was my boss for 5 years. And I learned a tremendous amount from all of those people. And you're really in a role where coming out of school, you're still a student, right? You have a lot to learn, and I did, and probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today if I hadn't had that experience of having someone with a lot of experience. And also, like Ali said, a willingness to teach and have kind of a mentorship role in addition to being, you know, a boss. So I was, I'd say, the second technical person in the company. And as we grew, and he moved on to another role, I was able to fill into that position. And today I'm the head of engineering and a few other departments in the company. But that's really, you go through that transition phase where you're growing and learning from other people. And if that's what you make the most of, ultimately you can start giving back and mentoring the newer group of people that start working for you, and you build the team that way.
For me, when we first started the company, I was the controller, so focusing on the accounting side, which was, while I was an econ math major, I had only taken 2 accounting classes, so that really was not exactly my aligned with my interest, but luckily it's a small company, so it's not all about just the numbers. Then I moved into the director of financial planning and analysis role, which to me really was an exciting role because it's more about business strategy and where are you going from here, not just looking at making sure the numbers come together as they should. And so you got to see more of the how do you make business decisions and analyzing decisions. And then from there, I actually transitioned back to controller for a couple years and then moved to the CFO role. And I've been the CFO now for 5 or 6 years. So the one thing I do want to say that I didn't say before was, while it's difficult having bosses, everybody has bosses. Mm-hmm. Our CEO has bosses of the board and our investors. It's not just, who's your direct supervisor, especially once you get to the VP level. It's not just about your supervisor. It's about all the people that you're being held accountable for the overall results of the company.
Right. Yeah, founders are, everyone's their boss, right?
Right.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Right.
Even the employees under you.
Exactly.
You have a responsibility to do right by them.
For us, it was never difficult to, let go of those top positions because it was in our business plan. We were sophomores and a senior. We knew from the beginning we wanted to bring in senior management, people that had started companies and medical device companies before. So, you hear a lot of stories of founders being forced out and all that. That's another benefit of starting a company in college or right after. You want to bring in those mentors to help you grow. And so for us, we just wanted to focus on how can we create the most value at the time. And so our roles shifted over time. I started in product management when we were getting the product together, trying to define what is this going to be. We launched international expansion a while later, and I got into that effort, helped launch our first sales internationally, really started marketing the product, so I jumped back over to the marketing side, and now I'm VP of marketing, and I run our direct-to-patient sales channel.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that's great about being an entrepreneur, there's a lot of downside, but one thing that's great is you can make your own job. Over time, at the beginning, you do everything, and that's the downside. But as you get enough money and you can start hiring people, you can have them do the things you don't necessarily want to do, and you can focus on the things you're good at and things you like. So I always say it's the difference between taking a job and making a job. When you're an entrepreneur, you can make a job as opposed to just taking whatever they give you. Do you have another question in the audience? Okay, in the back corner on the right, if you have a mic.
I was wondering, in the initial stages, what did you guys, like, how did you guys technically execute the idea? Like, what were the first steps you take to actually make the product? And then afterwards, you said that you seek, like, different technical ideas, and you had to see experts in different fields. How were you guys able to find those experts and connect with them?
Good question. Again, it comes back to understanding the core elements that underlie your product and the technologies that are going to come together to make it happen. In our case, it's a very, very, it's a product that has a lot of different elements in it, from pneumatics, software, electronics, industrial design, kind of all the different facets of engineering. So, and trying to dissect that and understand what we needed to do, we talked to experts in each of those fields. And in a lot of cases, you have to start at the literature level. Some of that expertise came from an academic background, where we had professors that had started companies, you know, in a consulting manner, and they were obvious choices because they were writing textbooks and publishing, and you know, so you find people like that. Others are, you try, for the case of like an industrial design firm, you have to talk to enough people to understand what's going to be a good fit for what you want, your team, your product. It's like Ali said, there's that interview process of, are we going to be able to work together well? And so, depending on what kind of technical challenge, you have to go to the right place. Some are readily available, like industrial design. There's a lot of options. You know, pressure swing adsorption and oxygen separation, a little smaller field. So it's just a different scenario depending on what your technical challenges are.
Let's talk a minute about hiring those first employees. I even had somebody in my office hours earlier today. Like, how do you get your first employees? I won't give the answer I gave there. I'd rather hear your answer, because you were lucky to have an advisor early on that was very instrumental, became the CEO. But talk to me a little bit about that. If I remember correctly from a while ago, you told me that you often put people in advisory roles first, tested them out, and then brought them in.
Right. Yeah, so it certainly was the approach, because it was a way to kind of test drive people and make sure that they were good fits. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the people that ended up being employees kind of transitioned from that role. And so it's tough finding people that really will be a good fit and get the startup environment, because people can be excellent either technical resources or finance resources or quality resources for large companies that have complete infrastructure around them.
Right.
And they are excellent at that. And then you give them a blank sheet of paper and they don't know what to do. And so finding the people that could take a blank sheet of paper and create something, it's a much smaller list of people. So it's not just about people's credentials and have they had the experience.
Right.
It's, are they really comfortable in that type of environment? So advisors were a great way of finding that out. And there was a lot of, frankly, trial by fire.
Sure.
and figure it out and see who will really work. And frankly, the ones in the beginning that were willing to take a risk on us were the ones that were more entrepreneurial in
right.
their approach anyway. So,
yep. No, I always like that approach too. We sort of had a 90-day probation period for many years at some of my startups, just to make sure there was a fit and that both sides were. It's not just the company that benefits from a good fit. You know, obviously the employee does too.
And when you're really small in that early startup stage, your need ramps up too. So it's not as clean cut as you go from no hire to a full-time employee overnight. That's
right.
Typically, you can't afford it,
right.
Or people aren't going to, you know, come on board like that. So it is beneficial for everyone to kind of ease in and start with that advisor role and use the expertise. And then as the company builds and you gain some success and need more support, you can make that transition. So it's a pretty organic way to build the company's knowledge base and expertise.
How many folks are employed now?
A little over 350.
350. And one thing that's great about Santa Barbara, how many are in Santa Barbara?
It's about 170, 180 that are in Santa Barbara.
Okay. About a little more than half.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you're finding this. I imagine you are. What I always found was the loyalty factor is off the charts. Like, you just don't have people churning in and out of companies here in Santa Barbara. Once they find a good, healthy home, they want to stay. They want to stay and build, you know, build the company into something worthwhile. Have you guys seen that? A lot of your early employees, are they still with you?
Yeah, so, I mean, the engineering staff is certainly one that there's a lot of a loyalty and have been here from the very early stages.
Right.
So we try to, you know, kind of have people grow into various roles and keep their career path going at the company.
Right. Yep. That's one of the advantages of Santa Barbara.
They're very happy to tell you how senior they are in the company, and they're always looking to move up that number.
It's so. Quite a pecking order. Everybody yes. knows I was hired number 12, or I was hired number 18, or whatever.
And they're awesome. Proud of it.
Yeah, they should be proud of it.
Also helps.
You know, what you do matters too, and as an entrepreneur, you can pick what you want to do. But even for us, helping us, you know, over the years, it's really helped that we get to change people's lives. You know, and we really try and put it back in a perspective that every unit, you know, that ships out the door is actually changing a life.
How many units have you shipped?
Well, since we started our direct-to-patient strategy in 2009, we've sold or rented to more than 40,000 patients.
40,000. Nice. Changing the world, making an impact, guys. Do we have another question out here in the back? Oh, I'm sorry. Up, right up here.
Hi. This is more of a general question. So, most like entrepreneurs, one of the best things they have is like their ability to come back from the low points. I was wondering if you guys could share like maybe a personal story of a low point or a big setback, and then how you guys came back from that, and maybe some lessons you learned from doing that you could share.
Which so one? Many to choose from.
Why don't you all try to pick a different one?
Okay, I'll give my own and. I look back on it with fondness, and you'll understand why shortly. So early on, we were just trying to make high purity oxygen. Didn't seem like it should be that difficult. The textbooks, it sounded like it was really achievable, but everything's hard at that stage. And so we had been trying for weeks and months just without a lot of success, and we finally felt like we had some momentum, and myself and the other head engineer we had were really just on a streak. We were going to make oxygen. We were just minutes away, and we were making our molecular sieve beds. At the time, we were, you know, gluing pipes together to make these inexpensively and quickly, and we may have been a little overzealous in letting everything dry, so we got a new set already and, you know, flipped the valve to turn the air on. And it may have been our glue job. It may have been that the regulator was turned the wrong way. We'll never totally know. But before we know it, we see the pressure gauge just going off the charts. And as we dive to turn it off, we hear a boom and a big pop. And the cap blew. And we sent, I don't know, maybe a pound of almost like sand-sized stuff in our very small workspace directly over the one cubicle wall onto Allie and into her keyboard and her hair and everything she had. And that was the great zeolite shower of 2003.
Yes. And you're not supposed to inhale that.
Oh.
It's bad for you.
So that was quite a moment. And it was a low, and someone wasn't very happy at that time, but we came back from it. And
your hair looks great, by the way.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's
recovered.
It was later that day that we made the first high purity oxygen.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yes, you can be very, very low and turn it around. And that is something that we've done. Had to do a number of times.
Yeah, I mean, though, you guys have heard this, it's a cliche for a reason. The lows are lower and the highs are higher to start up. And you have to enjoy the highs. Certainly you want to celebrate those, but you have to be careful with the lows. You have to try to modulate that.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite all-time low?
Yeah, you know, probably the biggest lows that that I've experienced back in the early days were around cash management.
Yep.
And feeling like the constant pressure of, you know, I said earlier, you know, we had $72 in the bank. I remember that day that we had $72 in the bank and we had absolutely no source of capital. And I knew that we had $200,000 of bills sitting on my desk waiting to be paid. And you feel like the world is going to come crashing down on you. To me, what really separates the entrepreneurs is the ones that take that and say, okay, what am I going to do? I got to do something and just start doing anything to try and get out of it versus the ones that say, there isn't an answer. Right. I got to give up.
Right.
And so that certainly was a huge low, and trying to then go back to your investors and say, okay, we need some money. We really have an idea here. What can we do to bring in capital quick and make it happen? That certainly was a huge low. And obviously, I'm sure you can guess now, we got the money. So we did not, you know.
Spoiler.
Run out. But you start worrying about it, especially once you have employees. Because it's not just about the three
totally.
Founders.
Yeah.
It's now, am I going to make payroll next week? I have now, you know, at the time it was, you know, five employees that had changed their lives to try and help us create this vision. And the idea of them being out of work on top of our company and our dreams going
right.
up, it's a huge amount of pressure that you feel in those situations that can crack a lot of people.
Yep. I could share a similar, if it was my lowest low, but a low at Computer Motion, the robotics company. I had to go around and ask select individuals, hey, if I don't pay you next payroll, I'm not saying I won't, but if I don't, will that be okay? And I literally had people say, well, pay me half, or, you know, I can skip one. And so I had a list in my right-hand drawer of people I don't have to pay payroll to. I never had to use that list.
Yeah.
But I know that pressure. It's,
yeah.
And some people can't miss a paycheck. I mean, they need the money every 2 weeks, so it's brutal.
For me, it was really when we had to change our business model. Because we had a great product. You know, we had a large market. We had a great team, but sometimes that's just not enough. And so we really had to rethink our whole approach. And, you know, it could have been easy to say, and some of our, you know, early partners could have said, well, this is great, but the timing just isn't right. You know, you have to wait for this market to develop and convert. But we said, we're going to try and innovate on the business model as well as the product and some other areas. And that's when we decided to go direct to patient. So we had to reach the actual patients instead of go through primarily another channel. And we, you know, we had built this product for Allie's grandmother, and every patient, you know, that we had talked to, we did all this market research, and patients that were able to get product through the channel just loved it. And we were changing lives, but we had this roadblock. And so we knew we had to get the product into the people's hands who wanted it the most and who ultimately, you know, chose to pay for it, a large portion out of pocket. Mm-hmm. And it was a key time in the company when, they, you know, we may not have gotten a second chance to keep going.
Right. Do we have a question in the back? Bless you.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about your path from the business plan as it was in the competition to kind of a proof of concept, like mostly on the product side, but also in your business model.
Okay. That was, for us, at the business plan competition stage, we really just had a concept. We looked at the basic oxygen concentrator that was commercially there and said, how would we make that portable? What do we need to do differently? And we had a couple fundamental concepts that we thought would get us from point A to point B, and those ended up being correct. And that's the path we went down, is, okay, let's take for granted that we could do what was there today. Which was a little harder than we thought, but we got there. And then from there, it was, okay, how do we transform this into a portable device? And for us, that meant two things. One was adding a battery so it can run on battery. And the other was getting the size and weight down, which we ended up doing through using an oxygen conserving technology. But it was just that of breaking the overwhelming whole product into its component elements and working on them one piece at a time. And that was what got us there. And it was sort of the classic tinkering experience. That's one of the reasons I got involved was prototyping, whether it was starting with sketches, hand sketches on paper, then moving into modeling with, wood and blocks and other, kind of proof of concept to, SolidWorks models. And you really just have to balance making actual technical development progress and being able to demonstrate to the rest of the company, investors, other people, this is what we're going after. So it's having the vision out there of what this is what the product will be. See, it looks like this. It would feel like this. Oh, and here's the sort of ugly looking prototype that, see, if you almost close one eye, it looks like it would fit in that box, right? It's just kind of keeping those paths moving forward together little by little, and then creating that vision for people of how to get from point A to point B, and that's what they have to believe in.
You're not going to talk about your guy with the six-pack and the top hat?
That was a very powerful visual example, and to this day, I'm still fond of it, yes.
One thing that strikes me when we talk about the low points here is every company, every department or every group in a company has its moment in the sun, and oftentimes the company can live or die by that moment in the sun. You had to create the product initially, and it had to work. You had to make sure the company stayed financed. You had to figure out how to market this thing when it looked like the business model was wrong. Any one of those failures, results in the failure of the whole team. And I think that's stress, but it's also a great, it's very exhilarating to come through for the team, right? Hey, I got the company funded. Hey, I got this thing to be 5 pounds. Hey, I figured out a market channel that works. And that's, for me, just part of the excitement of being an entrepreneur, being on that team. Do we have another question? We have one over here. We'll get the microphone there. I have a question for you guys while the microphone makes its way over. So we've got a bunch of UC Santa Barbara students sitting here. If you could go back in time, besides going to another keg party, what else would you do that you didn't do or that you wished you had done to prepare you for your life as an entrepreneur? And we'll just go down the road. Or
I think, looking back, the technology management program was key, but I would have started even earlier. So we went to find the TMP program because, the classes were so theoretical. We were looking for a real-world application. And back then, it was really just lectures coming in every other week or so. And if anything, if you're in your classes wondering, what am I going to do with this information? How does this relate to the real world? I challenge your professors, how is this theory? And I get it, you have to know the theory before you can apply it, but you have to make that link, to stay engaged and to see the benefit. And, I had to go to an MBA program at a different UC campus to really see some of the fundamental things, I learned as a freshman and sophomore as an undergrad have huge application. And, as an undergrad coming out of school, if you're not going to start a company, you can make yourself so much more marketable if you know how to apply those things. If you know you're walking into a company, you can say some of the things you can do for them. So I get engaged and challenge professors.
Yeah, for me, I think overall the TMP program really was beneficial to me. And if I look back and think, what would I have done maybe differently, I really probably would have tried to not just focus so much on my major. I was pretty laser focused on economics and mathematics and, kind of that approach. And I think that was great, but in the role that I'm in, I think any one of us looking at being an executive of a company, you need to have more breadth. You need to understand, even if you're in the finance side, you have to understand the product side, you have to understand the market side, and really you have to be a good communicator, both in written form and speaking. All of that is really important. So I probably would have done more of that type of general education mm-hmm. that I think I was frankly too focused on what I was going to get out of my degree and not necessarily broad enough.
Yeah, sadly, as most graduates will tell you, you only use so much of your degree, right?
Right.
But you,
right.
But you use that sort of ability to learn the rest of your life.
So. Right. I'm not using much from the math side, I got to tell you.
Balance your checkbook, right?
Right.
Yeah, my answer is similar to Allie's in that I think there is tremendous value in everything that's available at a university like UCSB. And if I had it all to do over again, I would look at the electives I took to fill the GEs and things, not as the way to least disrupt the path to my degree, but as, you know, what is going to be the most valuable. And those, frankly, probably would have been more difficult choices to make. But as Allie said, you know, even being in a technical role, there's, as you move up in the company or you want to expand in the company, the expectations to understand the finances and everything else are certainly there. And there's never a better opportunity to start getting that education than while you're actually in school. And I do agree. That's one of the things I look for in people that I'm interviewing and hiring is that broad interest of, are they going to understand the business and understand why we're doing what we're doing and get involved and be, you know, a contributor to the company as a whole.
Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate you coming back. I know you're busy with the IPO. Let's give them a warm applause.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.